Monday, March 12th. So we have three items on our agenda, and hopefully we can finish them by 4:30. We won't have to come back and compete with other committees tonight. Senator Nelson? Senate File 2213.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. You might feel that you're having a little sense of deja vu today as you look at Senate File 2213, Principal Evaluation. You might recall that last year this committee passed Senate File 1022, which was Principal Evaluation. So you might wonder, well, why are we back here today with Senate File 2213? Just a little bit of history. As you might recall, when we passed the Principal Evaluation piece, which was signed into law, when we passed Senate File 1022 last year, there was not a teacher evaluation piece in front of this committee at that time. However, you'll recall that we do have teacher evaluation now, which passed out of the conference committees and was part of the final negotiations in 2011. And that teacher evaluation piece calls for 35% of the teacher evaluation would include student performance. And so the bill before you today actually mirrors that only for the principals. And you will notice there's just a very, you'll just notice the change in the language is on line 2.7 and 2.8, where it institutes the 35%. Principals are leaders in our school. They set the culture of our school. We know it's best to lead by example. And so this bill seeks to do that, which is just mirror the teacher evaluation piece. With that, Madam Chair, I have a couple testifiers. And while they're coming, I might just add that we have the very same authors on today's bill. That would be Senator Wolf, Senator Olson, and Senator Bonhoff, who are also on the original principal evaluation bill. So with me today, I have
Christopher. My name is Christopher Orr. I'm the Government Relations and Policy Manager for MINCAN. Madam Chair and Senator, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate File 2213. Principals are a significant factor in student achievement. Their talent, vision, and instruction are critical components to leading Minnesota schools and to solving our biggest challenges, including Minnesota's staggering achievement gaps. It's imperative that we not only hold our principals to a high standard, but provide them a meaningful and results-oriented evaluation structure so they can grow and develop. We strongly support connecting 35% of a principal's evaluation to student performance outcomes. This is consistent with the same standard to which we now hold our teachers. This is a necessary first step towards a strong and more robust principal evaluation model and ensures teachers and school leaders are equally focused on the academic learning and achievement of their students. MINCAN is not only is not alone in this belief. In the recently released Viva Project report on evaluating Minnesota principals, produced through a partnership of Education Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Education, teachers said, "We believe that if a given measure or of student performance is ultimately used to evaluate teachers in Minnesota, the same measure should be reflected in the principal's evaluation." Moreover, in our recent survey of 1,000 Minnesotans on issues pertaining to teacher and principal performance, 92% of Minnesotans believe that student learning progress should be an important factor in evaluating the performance of a school principal. MNCAN strongly encourages collaboration between principals and districts in developing evaluation models at the local level. However, if they are unable to reach agreements, then our state should require districts to adopt the state model created through the work group. To further encourage principals to focus on the development and support of teachers, we also believe we should include teacher performance in principals' evaluations. As a participant of the principal evaluation work group, I can attest to the hard work that was completed by the group in a short period of time. However, it seems our work fell short of including these necessary elements to make the system as meaningful as possible. Status quo approaches are not going to cut it. In closing, let me again share the thoughts of Minnesota teachers from the VIVA Project. Equal treatment for teachers and administrators as it relates to student performance data will promote collaboration and trust. Anything less will erode working relationships and decrease positive student outcomes. We couldn't have said it better ourselves. I urge you to support this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the witness? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think a question that kind of runs through my mind is, how do we know 35% is the right percent? And the other part of it is, if we had some idea of the process, it would be a little bit easier to understand if that percent fits into it. I think this kind of goes along with the previous bill that we had talked about that I believe Senator Nelson carried, when we start talking about evaluation and the evaluation process, I think for the teachers is kind of ongoing right now or in process. For the principals, it's going to they're going to end up entering in the same process, which I think overall is okay, but here we are as a policy group and have no real kind of comprehension, at least I don't, as to how this is all going to work out for those people who are going to be involved in this process. Like, you know, in the case of teachers, you know, education sometimes is very difficult to kind of measure. Now, I think you can use a test to some extent, but in now we're going to step one step removed from that kind of measurement tool to try to use that same process for principals. And so you have, you know, we heard the arguments in committee about, you know, you can have a good class where a teacher can teach 40 students and do very, very well, and the next year that teacher may have 20 students and just be buried because of social kinds of issues that are coming up, and so the progress can vary immensely, and yet that same teacher is going to be 35% is going to be based on it, and then now the principals. So I guess I would like to somehow get a vision around what this process is going to look like. How is it going to operate?
The working group actually discussed many of those elements at length, and the report that was released by the department actually does include student data in the model, and what the working group agreed to is, since we were also working on the waiver, they agreed that the elements that are used for accountability for the school were appropriate elements to hold their school-wide goals that you would hold principal to, as well as the model gives room for the inclusion of local goals pertaining to student achievement, which could be participation in advanced level courses. It could be, I can't remember the other elements, sorry, they just escaped me. But and then again, the system allows the principal and the superintendent to set the specific goal that a principal would be attempting to attain in a given year. And all this would call for is that portion of the evaluation be considered at 35% of the overall evaluation. So I think that, in terms of process, is what was discussed on the working group. In relation to the 35%, I think as a legislature and governor and so as a state, I think we've set this standard for our teachers. I think it's fair that we set that standard for our principals as well, again, to build that community around attaining the same goal, and that's the achievement of students.
When your task force was meeting, I mean, it seems to me that with the principals, they're dealing with an aggregate of the whole.
Yes.
Which it would be a lot easier to attain than it is in terms of differentiation than with the with individual teachers that are teaching in areas where that evaluation is probably carried out in different forms. I'm not sure how you aggregate that all, but a lot of stuff would kind of come out in the wash, I think, which would make that a lot easier for the principals to attain. Now, maybe some of them would like to argue with me, but in which that's just fine.
I'm not a psychometrician, so I'm not exactly sure how that works out, but it would be based on an aggregate of the school.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Nelson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple things to add that I think are important for the committee to note. The Nickleby waiver that we received, you might recall that specifically, I'll just read for you in there, this is what our application stated. The Principal Evaluation Work Group is currently considering the use of longitudinal data and school-wide student academic achievement growth data as an evaluation component. District achievement goals and targets will also be incorporated into the evaluation process. The recommendations of the work group will determine the degree to which student achievement measures will be part of the statewide principal evaluation model. So in our application for the waiver, it was very clear that there would be student achievement measures in our principal evaluation. Now, to Senator Stump's point, I can't tell you that I know that 35% is the magic number. I don't know that. But what I do know is that is exactly what the teacher's student performance is measured on. And so it's very important that we do have some consistency there for all the reasons that Christopher measured. And I will tell you that my teachers in my district specifically said that exact thing to the T. You know, if we're going to be measured on 35% student performance, we would at least expect our principals, the leaders in the school, to also be measured on that exact same performance measure. So I think that's an important piece to recall, in that it was part of the waiver, and our teachers are measured on 35% student growth, student performance.
Thank you.
And I have one more testifier, Madam Chair.
Right, Senator Nelson, introduce
yourself. Okay, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Shua Faith Moore, and I'm speaking to all of you today as a school principal and mother of two students who attend St. Paul Public Schools. I currently serve as a principal at Bruce Venter Elementary School, which is located on the east side of St. Paul and is part of the St. Paul Public School District. Thank you for hearing my testimony this afternoon in support of Senate File 2213. Bruce Venter Elementary School is a thriving pre-K school that serves about 570 students. Our students come from diverse backgrounds and include 50% Asian American, 25% African American, 23% Hispanic, Latino, and 2% who are either Caucasian or American Indian students. Of these students, 95% of our students qualify for free and reduced lunch, 75% of our students are ELL, And of this number, we have over 100 students who are new to the country who don't speak the English language. A part of our school also serves self-contained federal level 3 program for students who have been diagnosed with emotional behavior disorder. In all walks of my life, as a principal and educator to a mother and wife, I value feedback. Feedback from others affirms that I'm on the right track and to help identify opportunities for me to grow and develop. For the first time this year, St. Paul Public Schools is implementing a new principal evaluation system. This process includes a revised principal evaluation form, the 5 essentials from University of Chicago survey, and 3 times a year goal-setting check-in meetings with the area superintendent. This process provided an opportunity for me to share the progress my team and I are working in terms of making students and in terms of with our students and models for my area superintendent to give constructive feedback and support to further guide my practice. This process is based on a strength model and not a deficit model, and I found it to be non-threatening and affirming. While this is a great step forward for my district, I know that this is not always the case across the state of Minnesota. I believe meaningful, results-oriented, and multifaceted feedback is a testament to an organization that is striving for excellence. For Minnesota principals, our performance, vision, and instructional leadership is key to student success. We are the CEOs of our schools, and we must work with our teachers to help our students get ready for the real world. A good leader doesn't sit back and take credit only when things are doing well or going well. A good leader digs in with her staff to ensure that everything is being done to put kids and learning first. Through your leadership and the governor's commitment to education, Minnesota now has a teacher performance evaluation system in place and is well on its way to having a great principal eval system. A great school leader accepts responsibility for what goes on in his or her school. I expect that my teachers give 100% every day, and when 1/3 of their performance evaluation is now connected to helping their students learn and grow, I believe it's ethical for me to model the same expectation. As principals, we may not have control over state tests and evaluation systems. However, we do have control in how we set the vision, mission, and lead to create a learning environment that has high expectations for all so we can eliminate the achievement gap. I also uniquely understand that the students who come to my school today may not necessarily be there tomorrow, next week, or next month, or next year. Our children are moving seamlessly between our cities and our state due to many pressuring or pressing issues. Therefore, a comprehensive evaluation across the state of Minnesota will ensure that we have high-quality leaders and teachers all across Minnesota. And I know that I don't have all the answers, but I know some things may have to change. I entrust the teachers in my schools, my superintendent, my parents, and students to tell me where and when I'm doing well as my areas for improvement. We are a community, and the only way we can create a supportive and thriving school culture where our students are successful is to trust one another and provide honest feedback to help every individual grow. A comprehensive performance evaluation system that supports, develops, and provides feedback will begin to systemize this communication loop, and impact on student learning should be a main priority. As school districts in our state continues to work together to create accountability systems, I hope all of you will seek out and listen to principals like me who are leading by example and taking responsibility for the teachers and students in our schools. We will be working diligently to help our respective district administrators and all of you to better understand what resources and tools we need in order to be more successful at our jobs and ultimately help students learn. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Principal Ball.
Madam Chair, I have one additional testifier, Ms. Gran.
Ms. Gran, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I really appreciate your focus on school leadership. It's an often overlooked topic in these discussions on education. It's really heartening to see the committee's focus on this. My name is Jackie Gran. I'm the Chief Policy Officer for New Leaders. We're a nonprofit founded in 2000, a national nonprofit organization that develops transformational leaders. And we also work on designing effective leadership policies and practices with school districts and states. We recently participated in the legislatively mandated work group that created the recommended state model for evaluations in Minnesota. With 10 years of research and organizational experience behind us, we've spent a lot of time thinking about what really makes for an effective principal and what conditions need to be in place to support that success. We know that highly effective principals can get results regardless of circumstances. However, supportive policy conditions can enable more principals to effect greater change on behalf of students and also enable those principals to really sustain that change once they're doing that hard work in schools to make those schools better and provide support to their teachers. Principal evaluation itself will provide critical data that will enable the formation of a broader system of principal effectiveness. And this is a really key area where policymakers can support increases in raising student achievement. This is one of the reasons that we're here to support the passage of SF 2213. From our experience, we see that a strong evaluation system focuses on two primary areas. Student achievement outcomes is the first, and leadership actions that help students achieve is the second. So let's start with student achievement. We see principals as being responsible for the success of students in their school. And we recommend that when thinking about those student achievement measures, you're really thinking about student growth, you're thinking about the attainment of proficiency goals, and you're thinking about gap closing between your highest performing students and those that are persistently underperforming. However, those assessment measures unto themselves are incomplete when you want to get a full understanding of what student success is. And so you need to also know who's persisting in school and looking at non-assessment measures that are linked to student outcomes like high school graduation. When you take a look at those student outcome targets together, you can get a picture of how a school is progressing and think about those outcome measures as a condition for being rated effective or proficient. But when you bring these measures together and give them a percentage weight, as is done in SF 2213, we think that's a very strong approach to building an effective evaluation system and that this bill would achieve that goal. Strong principal evaluation systems also focus on leadership actions, what you're doing as a principal in a school to manage that school. And the best systems zero in on the critical actions that principals take as instructional leaders, as culture builders, and as talent managers of the staff within the school. Principals have that key role in boosting teacher effectiveness. They hire teachers, they develop teachers, they evaluate teachers, and they create the conditions for teachers to thrive. And a vast majority of teachers cite principal quality as the number one factor in their decision about whether or not they're going to stay in the profession or stay in any one school in particular, which is why that question about how we think about who and how we evaluate principals is so important to driving student achievement across the state. When you take these two areas together, looking at these student outcomes and looking at these core leadership actions, we believe this can provide you a well-rounded view of how a principal is leading their school. By passing SF 2213, we see that Minnesota will further encourage districts to adopt this type of system. As you consider the work ahead, we hope that you'll remember that the best use of a strong evaluation system is to provide the data that informs a continuum of preparation, of certification, of hiring, evaluation, and professional development. And that by taking actions across this continuum, you'll be able to create a core of principals that are not just resolute in their mission to raise academic achievement for kids, but also creating a system to support their success in that very hard work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Ms. Fran? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we have some people who would like to speak in opposition. Gary Amorose. And if we could, we're going to be on a time crunch here really fast. So John Miller-Huggin and David Adney, you can maybe come to the table or be ready to, and if you could, keep from either repetition or try to be concise, that would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And we'd like to just provide a few thoughts regarding the Senate bill that we're looking at, 2213. We want to make it clear that MASA fully supports the current law that was passed last year by the legislature and signed by the governor. That law clearly states that student achievement and school data must be included as a component of the evaluation process. Once again, I want to emphasize, we fully endorse and support that. I happen to serve as a member of the task force that's been mentioned earlier that provided by February 1st a copy of the model that was created by the task force. It very clearly states in that model that student data and the use of student achievement data must be used in the evaluation process. We also felt as a group that it was most wise to allow each school district the opportunity to determine what percent or what part of the total evaluation process would be based on that student achievement. All of our districts are different, and we felt it was best for the people at the local level to be able to make the decision on how they would view that student achievement data in part of the evaluation. Again, I just want to emphasize, because I know we have other individuals here, that we fully support the concept of accountability and have been working with our members to make sure that as they work within their districts, that they do make sure that student evaluation and student data is a part of the process. But once again, we feel that the amount of it or the component piece is best determined at the local level. And I would stand for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Do you believe that's the same for teachers?
I do believe
that. There should be consistency between the two.
I personally believe, and I do believe that our association, in fact, I wasn't executive director last year, but I know our association did have the perspective that we felt it was best that student achievement and school data be a part of the teacher evaluation process. Most definitely, we support accountability. But we also felt and still believe that it would be best served to have the local district decide how that piece is best utilized in the process.
Thank you very much. Are there questions, Mr. Amorosa? Is that right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, if the language of the bill on line 2.7, instead of saying growth as 35%, if it was changed to say at least 35%, so it would allow local districts an opportunity to make it 50 or 60, would that address the concern you're raising?
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm, the thing to keep in mind is that this bill calls for a model to be created that doesn't have to be followed by anyone. Each district has the authority to create a model based on the statute and then, you know, or can use the model that the state creates. I fully endorse the concept of accountability, but by putting in at least 35%, we're establishing a floor, which a system might be in a position where they feel it's not in the best interest of the system at this time to have a 35%. That might be something they work for. Some districts might want to go to 50% right away. But I think it's important that we recognize that all of our school systems are in different places in the evaluation process. Some of our districts have very high-powered evaluation systems in place already. And by having this type of language, whether it be a minimum of 35% or a straight 35%, we might be causing a district that's being very successful and working on behalf of children change things when it really isn't necessary. So I would still have some concerns about even a minimum, sir.
Senator Rieger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we haven't mentioned superintendents in terms of evaluation ratios, and if we're emulating the 35% teachers and principals, it's a superintendent who usually does the interview, recommends the hire.
Yes.
And has a lot of skin in the game. Mm-hmm. Why not have this applicable as well, just for consistency?
I think.
Burleson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Wieger. Superintendents, I believe, are held to a very high standard. Mm-hmm. I believe that as the CEO, so to speak, of a school system, the superintendent is held to the highest standard. Superintendent also has a different contractual situation, sir. Whereby if a Board of Education feels that what they're expecting is not being achieved, they can work with that superintendent to move in a different direction. So I think that the current employment laws provide more opportunities for a board to make a change in that area. And I do believe that as the executive officer of a school system, a superintendent is currently held to the highest standard, not only by the school board, but also by his or her community.
Senator Bonner?
I think he had a follow-up.
Well, Madam Chair, just maybe it's rhetorical, but if we as a state legislature have codified, you know, this 35% for the classroom, where ultimately the learning takes place, and, you know, that's where the high stakes are, at least right now, you would think that that argument could be applied for the system, and, you know, I just think you might want to be thinking about that, you know, the logic and, you know, the morale for, you know, the district in terms of, you know, we're going to hold you to this standard, but we're at a CEO high standard and not touchable. So it, to me, it would be better teamwork. We're all in this together if we had that standard together.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know I want to make sure to give your other testifiers, particularly the one who's from the district I represent, a chance to speak, so I'll be brief. But both Senator Nelson and I were on the task force as ex officio members, and first of all, I was blown away by the skill and the talent in that particular group, and I wished we could pass out the template that you guys created because it had more multiple measures approach and more, you know, taking into account all the various facets that go into what makes a great principal. And so I think that the work was outstanding. I mean, cannot say enough of how strong the product was. And yet also during that process, both Senator Nelson and myself, I believe actually the commissioner weighed in too, that we did prefer this 35% because we had passed it in law. And so I completely get where you're coming from and understand that's what you all as a group came to, but we did say that we thought the legislature would come in at it, you know, from that other perspective, because that is, you know, what we did with the teachers, and so we did recommend that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm John Millerhagen. I'm the principal at Washburn Elementary School in Bloomington, and I'm also past president of Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association. My connection with the principal evaluation piece, both as a practicing principal and then being involved in both the state MDE writing project to produce the evaluation document that the legislature requested us to produce, and then to be a part of the four leadership associations that have created the second evaluation document that you worked with and reviewed last year. And then Dave and I had an opportunity to sit on a national principal evaluation committee through the principal, secondary and elementary principal associations nationally. And we met with 18 principals throughout the nation and to discuss these very exact same kinds of things. And what I would submit to you is this, that currently as the law stands, without passing this bill, we have two very viable options for principal evaluation, very effective, very clear systems, and districts and superintendents will be able to use either one of these documents to the best of their ability, and you'll get results from this. This is going to be a really good work. What we found in our conversations nationally, where many other states have tried to accomplish what we're talking about with a 35% tied to teachers or principals or those sorts of things. And in our conversations around that group, people are really struggling with the part that Senator Stumpf mentioned. How do we do this? What are the implications? What are the unintended outcomes of going forward with this? I think it was Senator Wieger's question, do we support 35% for teachers also? Because of the nature of the unintended outcomes that come from tying a 35% student performance to the work that teachers do every day and how we evaluate them, we don't support it for teachers because of how that information can be used or can be applied in such uncertain terms. We spent 10 years with No Child Left Behind. A lot of good came out of it, but a lot that wasn't as good came out of it. And we're hoping that you're comfortable with this work that we've done and it is ready to go forward, and that you'll trust principals and superintendents in districts to do this good work. I can tell you that there's nothing more important to me as a principal than to make sure that every child in my school succeeds and they all have an opportunity to be career ready. I say that to my family groups. I say that to all of my parents. And and my children, and I'm a school that is 60% poverty. I can tell you that as I look forward to applying, if a 35% component went into place, that I think that'll be a hindrance to what you want local communities and school districts to do, especially smaller districts. And then this is an important nuance, but when you tie student performance specifically to a teacher's or a principal's performance, and the potential for that principal or teacher to have a career hiccup or bump in their career, principals and teachers may not use their strong skill sets and go to schools that need the kind of work that they know how to do strongly. They'll step aside and they'll go to schools where the negotiation around being able to for certain be successful in a 35% student performance model is more assured. And so with the number of questions that we have about what's happening with this 35%, I encourage you to let us continue with the evaluations that we have in place and give us a chance to roll that out and see how that plays, and let us do some of the other work that we're working on to close the achievement gap and to make sure that every child is succeeding.
Dave? Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Tomasoni.
I think it's to this point. I'm having a hard time figuring out what 35% means. In the evaluation, there's I think there's seven different guidelines for performance, and then 35% of the evaluation now to become on a longitudinal data of student academic growth. And so what does 35% actually mean? Because I don't exactly get it. If the students' data increased by 1%, is that good or is that bad? And or if it didn't increase at all, or if the school suddenly had a great increase, is what I mean, 35% of what is what I'm trying to figure out, because I guess I don't need an answer because I don't really
like
Senator
Tomasoni, I think what it's saying to me, and maybe there are different messages that come out from this, and we need to clarify that, is that if you had an evaluation system that had a certain number of points for various elements of it, some might have less, some might more, this would say that 35% of that 100% evaluation should be based on the student data.
There's seven things here that the annual evaluation must do, and mm-hmm. and then something comes out at 35%. And I think the old language is probably okay, because it's one of the factors. But this now says 35% of the evaluation. Well, I think
each one of those things that are a part of it would be weighted in some way, and we aren't dictating the weighting, but we are dictating, this bill would dictate the weighting in one of those categories.
I understand that, but I just have a hard time figuring out when 35% becomes good or 35% becomes bad or 35% of what, because when you talk about percentages, you multiply it times something. And so, that's when I was in school, if it's 35% of something, it's 35% times a number. So 35%.
What you're saying is, what is the characteristic of the student data that
correct.
Is going to be a
yeah.
part of that,
yeah.
on which you would then apply whatever that point system is,
correct.
In order to get what's
yeah,
in the
maybe,
evaluation.
And maybe one of these gentlemen know what I'm talking about and can answer it. But
well, I think the principal from the Minnetonka High School is ready to answer that. Welcome.
Either one of you. Welcome. I think this gentleman wanted to. Did you want to reply or don't?
Senator Olson and Senator
Tomasoni.
I'm sorry.
You read all the letters right. That's good. Okay.
I'm sorry. That's part of the challenge around the ambiguity on how this would really be applied individually in each district. I would remind you that the task force, the working group from the MDE, all the stakeholders in that group, in our final decision making, chose not to put the 35% within the document that was created. And a good portion of that, I believe, was because of the ambiguity in the application, and that we would be able to do that in a way that was essentially successful.
Sure.
Okay.
So,
Dave, I'll
hand it off to you. Welcome. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members
of
the committee.
We're getting into crunch time, so I'm going to urge you to be as concise as you can.
I will be
drive
concise.
Home the point that you know we want. You want
very
us to
well,
understand.
Very well. Thank you. I'm Dave Adney. I'm principal of Minnetonka High School. We have a very strong school district, and I'll try to make my points very concisely. One of the reasons Minnetonka leads in so many ways, and school districts like Minnetonka lead, is that we have come through the last few years and embraced educational research. It drives our practice. It drives student achievement, all that we do. When you look at the percentage placed on teachers first and foremost, there is no educational research that says we get a better product. I'm not here to argue that. That's past. But there have been statistics thrown around this afternoon that would make you believe that 90% of the teachers support that for principals. They've already been led down a wrong research path. There is no research. There is compelling research that says don't do it this way. Now, that hurts me deeply because in my previous life I was a math teacher. I love percentages. I live by percentages. This is not good. Here's the reason. Let's look at it this way. First of all, there's unintended consequences I think John spoke to. We heard this at the national level. I had several discussions with people. If you're going to choose where to go to be as a teacher or a principal, and you know there's troublesome places to go, they will not go. They will not tackle that necessarily. Inadvertently, through no fault of your own, you have now put in place a mechanism that will widen the achievement gap. And first, I think Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. I can see that happening, and that was mirrored in many discussions at Washington and on the state level. But most of all, and I'll finish my point with this, Madam Chair, I'm missing the logic. I so respect the work you do, and I want to call to mind just a couple things that have come up where you have looked to practitioners and to research and made incredible choices for the state of Minnesota. A few years ago, H1N1 attacked our schools. Terrible things were going on. Who did you call? You called practitioners. You called medical people. You called CDC in Atlanta. Things were out here. They were snapping through our schools. Our kids were kept safe. You talked with practitioners. 2 years ago, a bridge fell into the water in Minneapolis. You didn't try to do this yourself. You called practitioners. You called engineers. You called the best people around the world to say, what is wrong? How do we fix this? So I'm at a loss today where there is a gap. There's something that people love to do, and that's guide student achievement. And you would not look at the practitioners and the experts that have sat on these panels that are saying the percentage is a bad idea. Let local districts do it. Make it into a learning tool where districts will report, how much are you actually doing? Trace the districts that are improving the most and see what percentage. Maybe we'll find that you need 50%. Maybe you'll find you don't need those guidelines because the practitioners in Minnesota, and John and I found this out, we are blessed in the state of Minnesota. We have great educational leaders. 35% is a mistake. It goes against research. Right now, with such compelling research out there, why would we multiply the mistake that's been made with the teachers' legislation? Thank you.
Would you provide some either links or some references on some of that research? I think there's some that would like
absolutely
to have a look at that.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And if you're going to be around here for a bit, there's further questions. We want to get the two leaders of the organizations up. Senator Torres Ray?
Madam Chair, I have a question for the testifier, if
sure.
I may. Thank you. I find your challenge very adequate and welcome, because I do believe that we need to rely on testifiers, and I happen to appreciate statistical analysis in education. There is an issue with respect to perhaps whether or not 35, 25, 16 is or isn't a good number. But there's another issue with respect to articulating the issue itself in policy in order to measure an outcome. And I would like to hear from you, is silence better than identifying a percentage that is not perhaps the best one? And the reason I say this is I have a question about the 35 too. I don't know if it is an adequate number. I also have a question about, in Minneapolis, for instance, we're trying to really find how principals can go to schools good principals can go to schools where we are failing. And so if we put a 35%, a good principal is going to go? I don't think so, because the number is not going to add. And so this could be problematic. Yet being silent about not identifying a percentage of growth is also a problem for us, and that's why we have these gaps in Minnesota, and nobody says anything about it. So is it better to be silent completely, or what language do we need to use in order to encourage, you know, that kind of process through which we identify an outcome that is based on numbers, and then we encourage people to say, well, you know, I do want a principal going to this school, and we might have to provide an incentive, but I do have a number that identifies what growth is, because right now we don't have that number.
Let's let the man answer here. If you get it.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would not equate silence with none. Every principal that I've spoken with, and John, this is what we do. This is what we do because the research is so compelling. We can measure things now that we couldn't even measure 5 years ago in terms of this. I would state something that you must show artifacts and resources. Don't tie it to a percentage right now. Let the research, let us grow together as an institution across the state to see what's working best. To tie it down, you're going to have people chasing false targets just to say they did it. It's a waste of time. See what the best, demand artifacts, demand some kind of student thing. I can't imagine how a principal could defend their position or student achievement without bringing artifacts ahead. But to put a pure number on it that is not based in research at this point, let Minnesota be leaders. Let us put it in and leave it open-ended and then sharpen the pencil every year as to what we see great districts doing and work towards that, because then we'll have some research base to say 35% might have been right. We should have never fought. We might find out it has to be more than that. We might find out that the focus will come with higher principal training, that some years it may be very little, but the school will still be improving. And there's research to support that. For those of you that saw the bullying clinic gathering last week, we know that some of our schools, the research is clear. If kids feel bullied and harassed, their test scores go down. They cannot achieve. That's clear data. That's universal data across the nation. So for some principals to go into a new school where maybe it's the climate and the culture, they may spend the first 6 months of the first year getting the culture right. And the math test won't show it, reading test won't show it, but it will play out. And I think that's the kind of things. Those are the discussions we've got to have. But again, let practitioners lead. But I'm going to say that by not having a percentage means we're not using zero. It's simply self-assigned or self-guided by the superintendent. And let superintendents lead that.
Thank you very much. Thank you. The other two that are ready to testify?
Madam Chair. Just one comment to Mr. Adney. Do you have time?
Just quickly, because Okay. Otherwise your bill may have to go up.
Okay. I hear you. Oh, I don't want to have that happen. Mr. Adney, I just want to point to that we're not saying that it's 35% of, you know, any particular growth. We're saying 35% of the evaluation is based on growth. It doesn't even say in what way you use your growth data in at all. It's just literally saying the same percent that you're doing with your teachers you want to roll up. But again, it gives you a lot of flexibility. And so I remember there was a lot of debate. It wasn't exactly unanimous. There was quite a bit of intense debate. But I do think the world of the practitioners. But I would just ask you to look at this in a little broader view than thinking that we're really pigeonholing a score, because it's just not meant to be that way.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was the point I was trying to make, too, that the proportion of it. Mr. Stewart, yes, hurry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your question. Do you have any evidence, documentation regarding the issue of a percentage attribution to teacher and or principal evaluation? Grateful for the question. We do.
I think the claim was that there's research base for all of it. I think some good research base might be of interest to a number of members, so if you want to link that to it.
Yes. The fact of the matter is, and my colleague, Fred Storti, Executive Director of the Elementary Association, and pardon me, I'm Joanne Knuth, the Executive Director of the Secondary Principals Association. You will, in fact, find no research data or empirical evidence that linking an attribution of a percentage regarding student tests or value-added measures has any impact on student achievement. I've asked this question of numbers of areas, including Val-Ed, which has produced arguably one of the premier 360 assessment instruments. I asked them to search their research base. There is no research regarding the impact of an attribution of percentage of evaluation for student achievement or value added impacting increased student learning. On the contrary, we do have evidence, research-based, and it is in this document entitled Education Leaders Issue Brief, Evidence and Effects of Student Performance Data Applied to Teacher Evaluations. We do have evidence from the Brookings Institute, from the RAND Corporation, of the negative impact of an attribution of percentages in terms of its impact on the culture, on the reliability and the equity of teacher evaluations across the board. So I hope that you will find a moment to read this issue brief. It is research-based, and the attribution of the research is on the second page.
So if there's no attribution to having it, it does bring back the question is, why wouldn't some go to zero? I think that's what Senator Bonhoff was raising. I mean, should the student data have any impact at all in terms of this scoring or however you handle the evaluation data?
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. If I may, the use of student data in the evaluation process of both teachers and principals is critical. It's at the heart of the evaluation. As both principals have discussed a minute ago, so we do not advocate not using student data. It is centrally important to the process.
Okay, now would you tell us how?
In the evaluation
process. A possible effective way of using it in terms of the totality of that principal or the teachers. Can you concisely state that?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Principal and teacher come together, or principal and superintendent or supervisor come together and establish goals at the beginning of the year. And those goals are addressed throughout the year periodically. For teachers, the best kind of evaluation principals do would be to do a series of observations and at the end of the year to assess the outcome of those goals, predetermined goals, at periodic check-ins throughout the year, which is identified in both models of the principal evaluation presented to you. The summative evaluation occurring at the end of the year between principal and teacher or superintendent and principal will include a review of that documentation with appropriate assessments. We right now only have four statewide assessments for reading, math, writing, and science. There are numerous other subject areas, particularly at the secondary level.
We know all that.
So that begs the question, how do we implement this kind of process without the tools in place to do it?
Well, that's exactly why I'm saying would you end up not using it at all. But anyway, let's hear what you have to say, Mr. Story.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Fred Storty, Executive Director of the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association, and a principal myself for 27 years before coming to this position. First of all, I just want to say how much we do appreciate the statute that was passed last year around principal evaluation. And that statute that you passed last year is asking us to do things that we haven't done before, and we take that very seriously. That's why the three administrator associations last year took it upon themselves to develop this process, and this was done by 17 professionals based on the competencies in Minnesota. And in this process, we embrace the use of data to make decisions. We embrace the use of evidence in the evaluation process for principals. And as you all know, this fall, Minnesota Department of Education and the three associations had another group, this time of 31 members.
We're running way over. The cons have had much more time than the pros, and you're not telling us anything that we haven't that we don't already know. So well, can you kind of make
a
statement and wrap it up, because we need to go on to the other bills.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
Because we're supposed to be done by 4:30.
Right. I'll be very brief here in concluding. I hope that you would consider what two groups have done over the last 18 months. And much of the conversation was very passionate discussions, and Senator Bonhoff can attest to this, around the attribution of a percent on these evaluations. There is no research that would support a direct link between the use of test scores and principal performance. Do we embrace the use of data? Absolutely. Is there any new evidence that would say that there's a direct correlation? There is not. So we would hope to be able to go forward with the work that we've done around these two models that have come out. And with the latest model, there were probably 4 or 5 dissenting opinions out of 31 about the use of the 35%. So we appreciate your consideration of leaving the percent to be a local decision that school districts can make in implementing the principal evaluation process.
Well, thank you very much. Senator Nelson, how would you like this handled?
Madam Chair, I'd like to just make a couple closing comments, and then I would move the bill, and I'm not sure if it would go directly to the Senate floor. But my comments are, you know, everyone in this room wants to do what's in the best interest of the student. We're not interested in what's in the best interest of anything else. We're interested in doing what's in the best interest of the student. And I appreciate these testifiers right beside me today who testified in favor of a bill that we passed last year, Senate File 1022, for principal evaluation. And you might recall, I'm a daughter of a principal. I have great respect for principals. I've been around them all my life. But what has happened since we passed that bill, Senate File 1022, is now we have teacher evaluation. Teacher evaluation does include 35% of the evaluation based upon student performance. That is what this bill is mirroring, the very same percentage. There's great flexibility, Senator Tomasoni, in how that that student performance is tracked and measured. Okay, we're just saying 35%. I would like the committee to know that this language came to us from the department because I believe they were getting a little antsy in the fact that No Child Left Behind waiver specifically said that we would have a principal evaluation that included student performance. And so it is very critical that this legislation come forward doing that. With that, I think I'll just renew my motion that Senate File 2213 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Tomasoni.
Well, since Senator Nelson used my name, I feel like 35% has been plucked out of the air. And regardless of whether or not it has something to do with teachers in the classroom, principals aren't in the classroom. That's one thing. And number two, we haven't even let the statute go to work yet to see if it's going to work in the way it is. And suddenly we're now prescribing something new. And it just doesn't seem logical to me. Maybe it's the right thing to do. I don't know. But it seems to me if you have 7 different criteria for evaluating, I guess it's okay to put more emphasis on one than the other. But I think you're going to find out down the road which one is the most important and how they appear to be important. But to say that one has to have 35% of the value, I don't see how we can actually determine that in sitting here at this table. And I don't think we should pass this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stubb.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we put a lot of things in the statute that the people don't actually watch or do. One of the things is a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. That's in the statute. And so I don't feel that it's right to move this forward when you have so much testimony from the practitioners out there that feel it's going a step backwards. And if the reason for moving it forward is because the teacher's evaluation is at 35%, that's not a good reason. Because that's in 2016. We have a long ways between 2012 and 2016 to find out what they come up with. And so I think that we're trying to push a little bit too fast.
Madam Chair?
Senator Thomas Lane.
I'm agreeing with you. Okay, I didn't know about that 55 mile an hour thing. I thought you said.
Okay, so if there's no further discussion, all in favor of Senator Nelson's motion to approve Senate file to 2213 and send it to the floor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails.
Division.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The division has been called for. All those in favor, raise your right hand.
All righty.
Opposed? On a vote of 10-5, the motion does prevail. The bill is passed.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff?
Be quick. Madam Chair, this is a bill I'm bringing forward really on behalf of the principals, and so I, rather than take you through it, I'll just turn it over to my testifier, Roger Aronson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. This is a straightforward bill. It has. I'm Roger Aronson, and I represent both the elementary and the secondary principals associations. This bill will allow school districts that are looking for substitute principals, and primarily in the rural small districts, that they can hire them if they haven't taken the continuing education credits, but they have a principal's license, provided that the contract that they enter into is 15 days. It's not more than 15 days. This is the same as the substitute teacher continuing ed license as well. The staff raised the question. This says that the Board of School Administrators would adopt rules for establishing this. Our assessment on that rulemaking cost is that this would be a non-controversial rule, that it would be a minimal cost, and that I have visited with Stan Mack, the executive director of the board, about the bill itself, and which they had no objection to, and it did not appear that the cost would be a problem, that the board would be able to handle that.
Madam Chair, this cost issue hadn't been brought up to me until it was discovered by our good finance staff today. And so, as I understand it, and Mr. Nauman can confirm, it looks like the cost would be minimal.
Madam Chair, the bill did pass committee in the House and is on the general register in the House, and the cost issue did not come up there.
Okay, is there...
Mr. Nauman,
do you have any comment?
Madam Chair, I can just amplify what's been discussed. I had conversations offline with the Department of Finance. Traditionally, for a non-controversial rulemaking process, we would book a cost of $10,000. The Department of Finance and I talked about this. This seems even less than what we would call minimal. So I think the cost is probably in the neighborhood of about $1,000, if not less. Certainly something that the committee may want to talk about in terms of whether that's eatable, if you will.
Okay. It would appear that this, because rules are a part of the current law, that it might have to go to state government. So there's no further discussion.
Okay.
Senator Bonoff moves that Senate File 1932 be recommended to pass and re-referred to state government.
Very good. Thank you. So moved.
Okay. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
It's passed on its way. Senator Cruz, 1889. One on school trust lands. We may have to carry over later tonight because I'm sure this is going to take a little bit more, and it looked like we had a catch-22 that we might be able to meet later tonight, but there was no room to meet in. But we have found one, so we will probably continue in room 107. That would be probably, I'm not sure, that would be flexible time, kind of be on call as to when we could get in there.
Well, then, Madam Chair and members,
remember, I just want to say, as it's in the agenda, the focus here is only on the issues as it relates to education. The ones that relate to the environment, natural resources, this bill is going to be heard there. So things that involve the DNR and the structure that affects that all should be done at the Environment Committee rather than here. But the impact in terms of your proposal on education are the issues that we want to hear about here. Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think this is probably one of the pieces of legislation I'm most proud of my entire career here at the legislature so far. Oftentimes, you know, we move the ball little bit by little bit by little bit, and that's the case with this bill. So before I go into that, into the details of the legislation, I'd just like to thank a couple of people who have come before me and moved this forward. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Wieger. Senator Wieger worked on the Legislative Commission diligently long ago and kind of brought some of these things to light. I'd like to thank my House Representative, Denise Dietrich, who has worked tirelessly on this issue year after year. I would like to thank my co-authors, Senator Bonhoff, Senator Bach, for joining me on this legislation as well, truly making it a bipartisan bill. And Madam Chair, I would like to thank you for all the work that you have done on this so far. So with that,
To move your delete all amendment, the A3 amendment?
If it would please, Madam Chair, I would like to move the A3 delete all amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it.
Okay, all in favor of the A3 amendment to the Senate File 1889, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, I am in a position to explain all of the pieces of the legislation here. But to your desire, we'll try and zip through this and just hit the education points very quickly.
Sure.
Essentially, what this legislation does is it transfers the authority of the management of school trust lands to a newly created Director of Trust Lands and Minerals and creates the Legislative Commission, Permanent School Fund Commission, and advise the legislature and director on school trust land management. This director will be selected for a four-year term based on names submitted by the commission. The commission consists of 14 members, including 3 members of the Senate, 3 members of the House, 5 public members appointed by the governor, 2 public members appointed by the Senate, 2 public members appointed by the House. With that, I'm just going to try and see if I can hit the most pertinent parts to our committee here. I think probably where we would most start, if we want to stay away from all of the Environment Committee stuff, of which there is a great deal in this bill, that will be where this legislation goes next. Let's start at Section 11. I think that is probably appropriate. Essentially, what Section 11 does, we'll start in Subdivision 1. That creates the new Legislative Citizen Permanent School Fund Commission in the legislative branch to replace the current Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee. The commission, as I mentioned, will consist of 14 members. And I already went through those, so I won't do that again. The public members of this commission will serve a 4-year staggered term and must have practical experience or demonstrated knowledge in a renewable or non-renewable resource management or development, real estate, business, finance, trust administration, asset management. Essentially, the point we're getting to here is that they must have an expertise in some of these fiduciary obligations that the trust would require. Trying to briefly just skim this here. Let's go to the director position, which will be created in this. We'll do subdivision 6 of section 11 talks about the nominations. This is how the new director will be selected. It directs this newly created commission to nominate 3 to 5 people for the governor to use in appointing a director of trust lands and severed minerals management. Essentially, we'll go to section 12 then. The policies and purpose is to establish the purposes of this new law on the school trust land administration and director. Here are some of what they are. The director is to oversee the school trust lands. The state must act as a trustee in the most prudent and profitable manner. I would just like to take this opportunity to mention, included in your packet is a very strict and legal set of definitions for what these fiduciary obligations are. So I think it would be important to review those. That's what we're talking about here, that will be entrusted to this new director. The trustee must be concerned with both current beneficiaries and future beneficiaries, so essentially the school children of the state. And then fourth, the new law must be liberally construed to fulfill the state's obligation to trust beneficiaries. Madam Chair, I guess with that, that's the basic layout of the bill. I could really get into some substantial detail here, but a lot of that, as I mentioned, has to do with the Environment Committee. So with that, I would answer any questions or hear any testimony.
Let's see where the members would like to take this discussion. Senator Tomasoni, you've got
I'm confused why, if you're going to make a public commission like this, why you would make it seem partisan, and why would you not have the Speaker of the House and the Senate appointing 2 members from each party as opposed to 2 from the majority party and 1 from the minority party? I don't think public schools is partisan, so.
Senator Cruz, would you like to respond to that?
Well, thank you, Chair Olson and Senator Tomasoni. I would like to agree with you, but in my time here at the legislature, I've learned that that's not always the case. And for the very reason that you're mentioning, I would like to make sure that there is a balance moving forward, and that
amend it right now and put 4 members of the Senate and 4 members of the House and 2 by appointed by each from each party, and the same, and the majority party can still have control of who gets appointed, but they just have to appoint 2 from each party as opposed to 1 from the minority party and 2 from the majority party. It'd be pretty easy to amend that right now.
There is, Senator Thomas, it seems to me there was a bill or a move to even do that with the current one, because that has not reflected that balance. Ms. Kelleher, would you like to address that?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. We were part of the bill to do that, and what we found is when we changed majority and minority bodies, a lot of the history that was going on in the school trust lands and a lot of the time and the effort was sort of lost. So we really would like the idea that we've got members from both sides of the aisle there learning about and managing school trust funds. And I think just what happened over this last year, we basically lost a year, Senator Tomasoni, learning about it, having all new people come on, and then realizing people like Senator Wieger is tough to replace. And so it makes sense. The policy is better for the kids of this state, and I think it ensures that we have participation from both sides of the aisle. And I just would rather not go through another period of when the trustees sort of goes back and relearns how to be a trustee. And you're an expert on these lands. I realize that, Senator Thomasoni. But I think there's some wisdom in having the majority and a minority party there. And Senator Wieger's experience and chairmanship of that group really sort of started all this. And it's just a shame he's not on there every time we meet.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I understood your response because I'm trying to get two members from the minority party on as well as two members from the majority party on. Because I think the way this is written, it seems partisan.
And Senator Thomasoni, we do have other legislative commissions where there's equal numbers, regardless of minority and majority. But is it ethics, pensions, maybe?
Yeah, there's all kinds of them.
Yeah.
Sunset Commission.
So, would that go ahead and offer an amendment?
Well, it would say on line 616, it would say four members of the Senate. Including two members from the minority party. And then on line 619, it would say four members of the House, including two members from the minority party. And I think that would take care of that concern of mine.
And if that, at some place, I'm not sure what the full track is for your bill, if it's gotten too big, I mean, maybe it should shrink a bit and it would be one of each from both sides. I
or
mean,
that.
It would still be the, you know,
or that,
the
yeah.
same thing. Mm-hmm. Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify. I think on line 5.19, to be consistent with what Senator Thomasoni is doing, we should change that number, commission of 14 members, to a commission of 16. Mm-hmm. Is that consistent, Mr. Knopf?
Yeah. Because, Madam Chair, it's possible that control of the legislature could shift next year, and I'd still be very fair to you, Senator Cruz, on what I'm doing here. So
Senator Thomasoni is moving that on page 5, line 19, delete 14 and insert 16, and on page 6, where's the line?
616.
6.16.
Change it would 3 to 4.
3 or 4.
And then change the word 1 to 2.
Delete 1 and insert 2.
And make the word member members.
Okay.
And then on line 619, change 3 to 4. And change 1 to 2. And change member to members.
Is there any discussion to understanding of that motion?
I'm sorry.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair and members, I guess I would like to speak against this amendment. Obviously, we will move forward with whatever this body decides. Regardless, this is a great piece of legislation. My concerns are this. Right now we have this citizen commission set up so that the number of citizens rather than elected officials are the primary decision makers here. And especially when we're talking about things like fiduciary obligation, I just see the potential for gridlock. And I would like to make sure that there is a definite direction on the way this commission advises the director, advises the legislature. So for that reason, I guess I would like to I would like to keep it the way it is. I feel that it's better served by a largely citizen commission.
So what you are saying is that increasing that to 4, it would be a kind of 8 and 8 public that may. That was what I was referring to. If it's felt to be too large or some other shift in it, whether there's another stop that could deal with that larger picture. I think what was of concern here was of that fairness of that balance. Because I know when the majorities changed, I don't believe there was anybody. They didn't have anybody on from the previous majority, and it doesn't necessarily make for a smooth transition and functioning of an entity. Senator Vana.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I'm the Vice Chair of the Sunset Commission, and that's a body where we have a blended citizen and legislative, and there are equal numbers of both parties, whether or not it's legislature or citizen. So I'm not telling you how to do it, but I think the intention of what Senator Tomassoni is doing here is just critical to functioning on this particular piece. And I would urge you not to oppose the amendment, but if you want to come back in your next committee and play with your ratio so that you still keep the intention and keep it balanced, Republicans and Democrats, but you have a different solution, that would be one thing. But I would just hate for you to oppose the amendment, because I think by doing it that way, as it leaves this committee, we're clear about the intention that we want balance of the legislators. You can, at your next stop, fuss with it in a different way.
So, in part of Senator Cruz, you mentioned gridlock. Were you thinking gridlock between the public members and the legislators? In other words, the legislators, regardless of party, would gang up, and that's where the gridlock would come? Or because there's different appointment. There again, there's four public members appointed by the governor, who is of one party, and two each from the appropriate sources in the House and Senate. There's.
That is how we do it.
It's that makeup. That technically, I would say that actual makeup is probably belongs in another committee's jurisdiction. But I don't think it hurts to, since we're the first one, we should have at it, and they can scold us afterwards if they don't like what we do.
And Madam Chair, it's not as if we legislators always agree to oppose something together.
Yes.
So I would think that just because there's eight legislators and eight public citizens, that wouldn't necessarily dictate gridlock. I think it would be the issue that might dictate gridlock.
Some of the discussion that we've had in visiting these school trust lands, I'm in total agreement with Representative Rugabina.
Exactly.
Which might... there's a bit of contrast.
Yeah,
there.
So that makes my point.
Well, Madam Chair, to answer your question, I'm concerned about both. I'm concerned about keeping this a citizens-focused commission. And to be perfectly honest, I am a little concerned about partisan gridlock between the legislative members. With that being said, if it be the will of this committee to move it forward, I am still going to obviously be wholehearted behind this legislation. We can move forward. I think there's a bigger picture here that we need to stay focused on. So that is my goal.
I appreciate that. You've worked hard on this, and obviously there's some different constructs going on over in the House. I had to give a little lecture at the last meeting that when it sounded like that was the bill that was going to remind them that we're bicameral and that the Senate hadn't started down this path. And so I suspect there's going to be some differences that will need to be reconciled, whether it's from the environment and DNR side or the education one.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina constantly reminds me that if we senators could wear wigs and robes, we would. And I tell them I would definitely wear the wig.
Very good. Is there any further discussion, Senator Wolf?
Madam Chair, thank you. Just wondering if possibly somewhat of a compromise, if sticking with Senator Tomassoni's want of making it even partisan-wise, and with Senator Cruz wanting to keep it as primarily a citizen group, could we decrease the number of legislators? And so instead of going up to 16, could we come down to 12 and have one of each party from each of the bodies instead of two of each party from each of the bodies? And that keeps the citizens in the majority of the group.
Have you considered that option?
Madam Chair, who says citizens are smarter than legislators when it comes to this? Well, you are a citizen when you're not here, so.
Well, this has been an interesting process of trying to elevate the visibility and the attention to that permanent school trust fund.
And legislators have had a lot to learn, as well as public members, and I think both have also made contributions, because there's a concern that we do have a fiduciary responsibility, and we've been sloughing a little bit in terms of our attention to it. And that was clearly on our side, because we were, any monies that were earned, we just threw it in the pot. And you never, schools didn't even know what was coming from this fund. And so, there was just really no knowledge of what role it had. And so all of a sudden you select it, just move it out of the, that was the first step that I think Ms. Kelleher and others had pushed us to give it separately so that the schools knew how much they were getting. And then you start looking at, well, what are we doing to build this corpus and to increase that revenue? It's hard to see how that needs to be partisan either. So, I mean, I certainly would like to see the partisanship as much as possible removed from this. So I would hope that you would consider that. If it's the size and that balance, there may be some other even steps along the way for getting that reconciled.
Madam Chair, I know that we're pressed for time here and we need to move along. So how about this? To Senator Wolf's point, I did think down that line as soon as the amendment was brought up. But I think after review, you want that expertise. And kind of to Senator Tomasoni's point, yes, we are citizens when we're not here, but these specifically define the types of citizens to specialize in these individual areas. So I think we want that breadth of knowledge there. So if we were to move forward and I had to choose between those two preferences, between those two, I would probably prefer Senator Tomasoni's amendment at this point.
Well, that's a great concession. On your part. Senator Tomasoni, were you listening
to that?
Well,
move that thing, man. Move it, Madam Chair.
Okay, if there's no further discussion, all in favor of Senator Tomasoni's motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I realize that this will probably have to go to a number of committees, but since this committee also deals with finance, and I know we ran into some issues on the floor with the finance committee and what other members may or may not have been exposed to, do we have a fiscal note on this?
Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, there is a fiscal note. But I don't know if it is to the A3 amendment. Specifically, we had to address some property in lieu of tax or payment in lieu of tax issues, some PILT issues. So I don't know if we have received a revised version since then. I guess I would ask staff if they have seen that yet.
Madam Chair,
I know you're wanting to move forward quickly, but one possible alternative might be if this does move out of here without a fiscal note, that members would all receive a copy as quick as there's one available. Usually we don't move bills out of the committee unless we have a fiscal note.
Okay, Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, I'll offer two quick thoughts. First, to the direct question, no, it is not to the amendment. And there was, I believe, a PILT change that occurred. However, the Department of Finance, in its wisdom, did not see an impact for the Department of Education as a result of their first go-around. And I don't see anything in my eye that's going to generate a Department of Education, thus the jurisdiction of this committee, for a fiscal impact. But I still think it probably makes sense for us to get you all a copy.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, I would still be willing to do that when we do have that, to ensure that all members of the committee do get a copy of that as soon as we have the revised version to the A3 amendment.
Thank you.
Do we have any testifiers that are speaking precisely to the education aspect of this and not the natural resources one? Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman,
we're really being pressured to close,
I'm
ignoring the pressure for the moment. But it would be kind of nice if we got this and could send it on its way today and not have to come back. I don't know if you feel that way, but maybe you do want to come back and we'll have some more testimony tonight and then try to move it to the next committee. So, okay.
Madam Chairman, I just would like to say that MSBA supports this bill and thinks these changes are wise in lieu of it. And Senator Stumpf also has been pivotal in this, and I want to thank him for his hard work on this issue. So we would like your support on this bill, and we will work hard, members, to see that it's written correctly. Thank you.
Sir?
Madam Chair, Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. I think essentially to the fiscal aspects here as it relates to revenues to the or potential revenues to the trust fund. I've had a good discussion with Senator Cruz about some of these issues. We think that at a subsequent committee, the underlying statutes relating to long-term economic returns to the trust and sound natural resource principles need to be clarified. We don't believe that, particularly on the forestry side, you'll see any extensive changes, no matter the structure, if we don't deal with the underlying statutes here. There's been a conflict for many years. We also think relative to the cost certification process, which directly impacts what ends up in the corpus of the trust, that there need to be some clarifications and improvements in those underlying cost certification statutes relating to administrative costs, relating to charging of costs for fire suppression. So we think that that needs to be dealt with. We think that there can be some improvements in the transparency of the cost certification process. There can be some legislative steps on that we think would improve returns to the trust. We appreciate Senator Cruz's openness to discuss those. But finally, we don't believe that creating an 18th public entity to manage timberlands, public timberlands in our state, which that's what this bill does, removes the management from the DNR and puts it into a different structure. We don't think creating a new structure is going to necessarily return more dollars to the trust, but we do think that clarifying these underlying statutes and providing some greater direction to the DNR on the fiduciary aspects and the cost certification can have an improvement. So
thank
we
you.
Like parts of the bill, and there's other parts that we don't like. Thank you for
thank
the opportunity.
You. Thank you very much. Any questions of Mr. Brandt? Senator Torres-Free?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to do this quickly. Senator Cruz, with respect to this, I think that part of the information, it's unclear to me. Behind this, I presume the intent is to increase the funding and to get get this fund into a better hand so that we can get more resources for our schools.
More funds going into the permanent fund, which generates revenue that then goes back to the schools.
So, I think the fiscal note, in my view, that we need to figure out, you know, if we move from where we are to where we go, these changes that we are proposing, the cost of them seem to me that will be quite high. And this is why. If you look in page 3, the authority that you describe that is described in current statute for Commissioner of Natural Resources, which goes on to say that, you know, the commissioner may accept on behalf of the state a gift, blah, blah, goes on. You are proposing to add that to on page 11 to the director. So we have two different entities. We have the director that you're now creating, accepting on behalf of the permanent school fund, donations, land. It's kind of described twice. And then on page 10, you say the director may enter into an agreement with the Commissioner of Natural Resources. And so as I analyze what you're trying to do, it's unclear to me how these pieces actually connect and who does the what, and you're saying they may enter into an agreement. And so if they don't enter into an agreement, but they both have responsibilities and authority because we're giving authority to accept gifts, it just seems to me that this is very unclear as to how this is going to work and how do we maximize. You're creating a new entity to really maximize our investment. I think, the intent here. But we have two entities, and then how one entity manages the investment in just economic terms versus the mandate that we have in here for investing in, you know, to maximize revenue from a DNR point of view in terms of forestry and protecting land and all of that. So those missions are different. You said that they may enter in agreement. Could you explain to me how those things kind of were put into legislation and how do you intend to work those things out?
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I'll try and do this as quickly as possible. I appreciate the question. To the first piece of your question, the obligations of the commissioner, those duties that you were talking about, those will all be entrusted to the director. So we are not actually creating a new branch of government here. Essentially what we're doing is we're creating a director position, and under that director position we are going to take and put all of the authority that is currently vested with the Department of Natural Resources and give that to the director. So no longer will that authority be with the Department of Natural Resources. And here's why we do that. We do that because there is a very, very different goal between managing land for profit, which is what our fiduciary obligation is to the school children of Minnesota with the school trust lands, and what I would say is the overarching goal of the Department of Natural Resources, which would be conservation and those type of things. And I think that's why, if you look in your packet, I wanted to mention as well, there are multiple sheets that compare even just the timber portions to other states. There's a sheet that lists some missed opportunities that should have been taken care of. Take a look at those, and I think what you're going to find as far as a fiscal note goes is this is strictly a transferring of duties, and then the end result to the trust fund, as proven by these other states, is going to be much more favorable. So I hope that gets to your question.
Well, Senator Cruz, let me try to hitchhike on that. The management structures you're setting up would then probably enter into negotiations, not necessarily hire foresters to manage forest lands, but enter into negotiations with DNR for their forestry. But the terms of that may be a little different than what is in fact happening now. That is the point that has been made along the way. The other thing, in terms of our jurisdiction, technically in this committee, is after that money hits the Board of Investment, and you're not changing that. In some cases, such as Utah, we had the folks here from Utah, they took over the investing of that money as well. We're not planning to do that because our Board of Investment has done a very good job of. In fact, I think if you all got the mailing from the MSRS this last time, that the last quarter, the earnings that the Board of Investment had produced was a 24% increase. I mean, that's pretty good in these times. So there's no sense to somebody new coming in and taking over that particular aspect. Okay. And so I think our concern is we want to see that maximized, but right now the tension will be between, you know, who does it, whether we support this structure or at least want to keep this dialogue going as it goes through these any other committees relative to that, and so that we as a legislature carry out our fiduciary responsibility as well. Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman and members, I just think the one point that I've learned over and over is right now with the present structure, the children don't have a voice in the game. And this would make sure one person had the responsibility to oversee, to answer the questions, to be on call, to provide transparency and accountability to the students of the state. And that's really the goal, and that's what's missing out of the present picture.
Sir?
Madam Chair, Dave Shad, Deputy Commissioner from DNR.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to keep this brief again and again focus on the educational issues and maybe more to the point the issues that Senator Torres-Ray brought up about costs and revenues to the trust and try to steer away from the natural resource issues. We do believe as trustee that we need to take a careful look at this. Based on that, we have significant concerns about this legislation. We do think that it will result in increased administrative costs associated with managing this 2.5 million acres of land and the additional 1 million acres of subsurface ownership. And we think the potential to raise additional revenue is fairly limited and somewhat speculative as well. We do charge about $9 million per year in costs to the trust. That involves about 130 FTEs. Most of that is field staff. Most of that is foresters, people that are expert in minerals management associated with getting that product out of the ground. We have literally thousands of additional hours. My time here, for example, today, leadership costs within the commissioner's office, division director time, and many out-of-pocket costs related to utilization and marketing, maintenance of campgrounds that are on trust land, many other costs that at this point are part of our day-to-day management. They're not assessed to the trust. It's a benefit of having these trusts being managed by a larger natural resource agency, and our estimation is that these additional administrative costs above and beyond what are being assessed to the trust now could run into several million dollars. And our fiscal note that we've been working on based on the bill as introduced does identify those various costs and the impact it might have on the trust.
So when will that be available?
We've submitted it. I'm not sure where it is in the process, Madam Chair.
Ms. Kelleher, you were wanting to respond?
Madam Chairman, we just did some quick figures from 2005 to 2011, trying to take a 10-year look at the window of costs for that time. And during that time, the forest management costs for this fund has increased 50%. Administration costs for our fund has gone up 172%. And the transfer of dollars into the corpus of the fund so it makes it to the kids is down 45% over 10 years. So it gives you a longer viewpoint, but we are really concerned that when you provide the service and write the check, that maybe that duty shouldn't be in the same branch of government.
Senator Ham?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify your comments. Were you saying that your time being here in this committee today, the cost of that would be billed to the trust? You made some comment about administrative costs that would be absorbed in the trust, and you mentioned, as for example, you're being here today. Is that what you were saying, that whatever your cost of being here is going to be an administrative cost added to the trust fund?
Mr. Shane?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, if this bill was adopted and an administrator was hired to oversee the trust lands, if there was legislation being considered that would affect management of those trust lands, that administrator, of course, would be obligated to come and testify and speak on behalf of the trust. And I believe I'm doing that now. And certainly, I think the bill envisions that the administrator would be paid out of those trust lands. Again, that's a benefit of the trust lands being managed by DNR right now. Those administrative costs, the trust gets a pass basically, and we spend many
you're
hours.
Saying that they're not charged.
They're
for
not
you being
charged
here.
Now.
Okay.
Certainly, if an administrator was here in my seat, providing this same kind of testimony, the trust likely would be charged.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Is there any further questions? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Senator Cruz, I think what would be very necessary for our committee is to have this type of information. I think that Mrs. Kelleher is giving some numbers that are quite compelling, is my view, but I don't have any of that information. I don't know if DNR has this information, but we need to compare. Because clearly, our obligation is to make sure that this investment is done properly and that we're not entering into a new, creating a new, you know, a new system or a new model that will yield, you know, same or, you know, worse results, but then we're paying more for it. So if we can look into, you know, what is being done now, what is being proposed, so that we can measure this, because we have the flexibility to come back and undo some of these things, but it's problematic. So I think that I feel that we don't have that information. I have some information that was given to me by the Department of Natural Resources that compare the investment that was given by a company that did similar, because it's different, difficult to compare. This is public land that we're, you know, it's our land. And so apparently there is a company that they compare this, and the results that yield on those investments were only 10% compared to 12%, which is what we're receiving. So we have numbers that I don't see in front of us. And you're proposing to change what we have into a new model that will yield better results, that will give us an opportunity to have a stronger voice for children, but I don't see the tables that actually indicate that that's the case. And the people who have been doing this work say that this will actually not do what you're proposing to do. But I don't know. You know, I'm taking your word for it. You think that it will. It will. And we want you to be exactly on the right path, because we do want this money for our kids. So the intention is good. I just don't feel like I have the information to go from one model to the other without those numbers.
Mr. Amoroso, you wanted to say you don't care to talk about this issue?
No, ma'am.
All right. We had your name down, but you've had enough. Okay. Senator Kreifler, okay. What's your pleasure? My watch, I think, is right, so we've got about 3 minutes to five, but I'd like to make a decision, or we come back and continue this discussion. Now, I think we've pretty well exhausted the testimony that's here. What would you like to do? You know, our responsibility isn't the management of the lands from the standpoint of that structure. It's the outcomes. It's kind of hard to separate this, because it's hard to separate the discussion of it. But Senator Cruz.
Maybe just one quick closing comment before we move on to a vote to forward this to Education Committee. That would be my desire. Environment Committee. Senator Torres-Ray, look in your packets. We have direct comparison to states specifically geared towards timber harvesting, which is what a majority of the school trust lands is right now, and they yield a much, much higher dollar amount. We have that broken down by state for a much smaller acreage. If you don't have that in your packet, I think everybody should have gotten it, but if you don't have that, I will get that to you right away. I think the main concern for this committee is, do we want to have one individual backed up by a citizen legislative commission to make these decisions and uphold the fiduciary obligations? And I would argue, yes, we do. We have, and I can show you these numbers. Perfect example is 2009, where 98% of the timber profits went back into the cost of doing business. That's unacceptable for the school children of Minnesota. We need to move this forward. We need to have somebody who has their eye on the ball. This legislative commission has tried. But we need to have somebody who is in a director position and make those decisions.
Now, I think you meant the advisory council that is.
Yes, Madam Chair, the advisory council.
That has kind of been advising DNR.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Thomasoni.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think the vast majority of the money comes from minerals and not from timber. But you're probably here because of what's been happening in timber. I would think that's probably what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that was correct.
Is there any further discussion? If not, Senator Cruz, you want to move
I'd like to renew my motion
the
to
1889 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed on its way.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
The meeting is adjourned, and we won't be coming back.